Welcome back to the Stock Market Option Trading Podcast. My name is Eric, and my guest today is also named Eric. In this episode, I've got Eric Smolinski from the ES Invest YouTube channel and podcast. I got him back on the show for a long overdue catch-up and conversation on really just all things trading. Now, as you're going to hear, we started this episode with the idea of applying first principles thinking to our approach to options trading. But man, I really think we kind of veered from the topic a little bit. So there's a little bit of a heads up there that we went down a lot of rabbit holes in this episode, which is in part due to the fact that we really just hadn't talked in a while. We were kind of playing catch up here. Now, with that said, I do think there was a ton of interesting nuances of trading, options, backtesting, psychology, all these things that I really think you're going to find both entertaining and educational. But keep in mind, both Eric and myself are independent retail traders. We're not financial advisors of any kind. Really, everything on this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. So keep that in mind. Now let's get into this super fun conversation with Eric Smolinski. And don't forget to check out his YouTube channel after listening. I'm going to put his links in the description, and we're starting right now. All right, we got Eric Smolinski from the ES Invest YouTube channel. You've been on the podcast before. He is my Viking brother from another mother. It's Eric with a K, and I'm Eric with a C. Get all that out of the way. How are you doing, man? Good to talk to you.
I'm doing awesome. It's great to connect again. I know I randomly hit you up last week because I was just thinking about traders. And then I was like, oh man, I haven't talked to Eric in a while. And then we just started connecting. And I honestly kind of forgot how cool it is to talk to you because I love the way that you think about markets. It's fun. And I also, for those that, you know, obviously can't see us right now, but I don't find it not humorous, the fact that we're both named Eric and we're both wearing gray shirts right now, completely uncoordinated, but we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have a beard and a full head of hair, and I'm bald and I shave. So it's, you know, there's a little difference for the audience. There. I'm the bald guy. If you happen to see a clip somewhere, but, yeah, man. So we connected last week on a random call to catch up, and we got into this really awesome discussion about partly what we're working on, but just our approach. And then at both at the end, we were like, we should have recorded that because I think we thought that would have been interesting and probably valuable. So I don't think we're going to be able to recreate that. However, what I wanted to do and what it got me thinking about, so some things I was thinking about afterwards is the idea of first principles. And you hear guys like Elon Musk, Chamath Palihapitiya, some of these big billionaire venture guys, they go back to first principles. And it kind of got me thinking about what we're doing. And even though we're doing different things, we are kind of going back, like we're just doing it ourselves. And I think there's an element of just like, especially when you talk about like zero DTE, very short-term stuff, this is new to everybody. So I think everyone has to go back to first principles here. But so with that in mind, tell us what you've been working on. I know you've been doing some options research on your own. So let's talk a little bit about that, what you've done and what you're doing to do your own research. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, man. It's interesting that you brought that up when we were talking before, because like you mentioned, it's one of those things that I feel like a lot of traders that do this long enough, we kind of start doing a similar process and we might call it different names and whatnot. But the I love that you're bringing this concept of first principles into options trading, because I think options are both one of the most beautiful things that exist, but very tricky. And I think it's super easy to get too wrapped up into deciding if you're going to sell the 16 delta versus the 12 delta and if it's 4 DTE or 6 DTE. And you're kind of like, you're trying to optimize these small pieces of it. And exactly like you're talking about, I think going to the first principles model is really useful to like go back and try to solve and think about the original problem set we're working on. And for me, when it comes to something like zero DTE options, I'm looking heavily at variance premia. And that's essentially what I'm looking to capture. The overwhelming propensity for implied volatility to trend higher than realized volatility. Okay. So the very first thing I think about is how can I get better at identifying the conditions where that's there. And you notice that I'm not talking about if I'm going to sell a straddle or a strangle. I'm literally just talking about this thing that I'm trying to solve for. And then I'll start worrying about what structure fits the best. How can I create some sort of strategy out of that structure that optimizes it to a degree without overfitting, those kinds of things. So essentially with the introduction of zero DTEs, I think it created a really interesting market for us to explore that allows you to get a lot of repetitions in on trading something like that, at least from my perspective, where I'm looking at it very much from a volatility scope. And okay. We were talking a little bit about how you started looking a little bit more at price, which I'm actually excited to learn more about how yeah. you've been navigating that, because that goes also to show one of the really cool things about trading is that you can have two people that look at a problem set with slightly different solutions. And the cool part about markets is that you can make money from the same overall thing with a different approach. They will have different risk reward profiles and different behavior paths, but I love that about markets. So I'm actually also excited to learn about how you're integrating more of the price side of things, but yeah. that's essentially what I've been looking at. And I mean, I've been collecting data for a long time now. I grab it from Cboe. And for those that don't know, if you buy like minute level full Greeks data from Cboe for any ticker going far enough, and Eric knows exactly what I'm about to say,
yeah.
super expensive. So that's not really for the faint of heart. It's not really, you know, something that you just kind of be like, oh, I just want to grab a couple pieces of data and see what I can do. It's a little more involved than that in order to be quite usable. But I try to remind traders that I feel like retail traders in general, we've become so overly accommodated that we forget that there's actually quite a bit of effort that goes into trading, right? We're used to free education available, free platforms, lower commissions, and we just think that we should get all of this stuff. Yeah. And sometimes we forget that you actually have to start turning over the rocks, and it's resource intensive, time, effort.
Yeah. Well, so the costs, you know, I want to go back to the Cboe data. So when I launched Alpha Crunching, which is looks more at price is way less expensive than options data because there's only one ticker, whereas basically every contract on every expiration has its own sheet or whatever it is, however you're getting the data. But you know, they killed me with the pricing, because when I launched Alpha Crunching and I was just getting price data, I would download the data each week. I'm a little bit more sophisticated now, but I was literally buying, it was like $30 a month for just SPX price history for 5 minute data. I wasn't even doing 1 minute. I didn't need 1 minute. I just needed 5 minute. And then they changed the rules and they were like, hey, anything SPX now is $1,000 a month.
Love it.
And I was like, but I only need, you know, price. I don't need all that. And so I basically got edged out and I had to go to another data provider, which actually has worked out great, because now it forced me to find a better way to now I can update my data like in a few minutes, whereas before it'd take me like an hour and I'd have to wait for the FTP, and you know, it was pretty clunky. But yeah, they jacked up the prices. But not only is the data expensive, handling, storing, organizing, that's even more expensive. So how are you managing that? How are you managing the, you know, 20 gigs a day or whatever it is of data that come? I don't even, 1 minute data is probably like
it's how massive. Much
do you know, yeah. like offhand, how much 1 day of SPX options data is on 1 minute?
I don't know what it is anymore, but it's definitely double digit gigs. And that's, yeah. that's without a doubt.
Yeah.
And so what I ended up doing was I set essentially a stack up at my house, and then I just built a really expensive computer that I just literally use essentially as a stack and something I can query against to house and manipulate the data. Because the other thing is they'll give you the data in a CSV file, but then when you go to open it, it'll be over a million rows. Mm. So if you don't have a computer yeah. that can open that, you're literally sunk from the start. So
yeah, we did that. We downloaded, not to cut you off, but like a few years ago, it was before SPX had gone 5 days a week. I was working with a buddy of mine. training buddy, he was a data guy. And so we weren't buying live data, but I was like, hey, let's just buy data for the last 5 years and let's just do some stuff. So it was just like, we just bought this huge chunk and it was massive. And you're right. It was, we opened up the CSV file. That's what it was. We got, we had one CSV per day and each one was, you know, 20 gigs or whatever it was. And then I had to get it to him and we did a bunch of stuff with it. But yeah, so you're not doing CSVs, right? I mean, it's essentially
not reasonable to manipulate it at that point. Yeah. And just to clarify, I don't actually buy data anymore on like a regular cadence. I don't have to, because what I'm doing is I'm scraping what I can find now and kind of grabbing what I need. The reason why I bought the really large data set originally was to have a robust block that I could test ideas and segment sections of time and analyze things. At this point, I mean, I've been trading for over 16 years now. So a lot of what I'm doing is kind of sharpening the sword, finding little other opportunities, but there's not really a need to have every single strike in SPX for what I'm doing anymore. Doesn't matter. Yeah. I essentially want like 150 strikes around the money, give or take, on a zero DTE.
Yeah.
And that's still plenty. That's still more than I need.
Yeah. But interesting.
Yeah. It's what I typically do is, I think Excel for a lot of people is pretty powerful, especially if you integrate some of the, you know, plugins and add-ons like Power BI and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, that's probably an easier solution. But I run most things through Python and SQL, kind of depending on the tasks that I'm doing, how I'm trying to manage the data set. It's just way easier, because otherwise the data set just becomes so robust that if you like try to manipulate it in Excel and there's too many rows, even with a really powerful computer, it still just takes a while. And you can get a super powerful computer that could do it more efficiently, but that actually starts to become like a server, like pretty space intensive, which I'm not exactly trying to do.
So you mentioned risk premium. And so kind of bringing it back to the first principles model of like what I, you know, identify the problem. Obviously we're trying to make money, so that's sort of a given, but how did you come to identify that as that's the problem that you need to solve? Why are you focusing on historical volatility versus realized volatility? Is that right? Is that what you're
implied versus historical? But yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. So why is that the problem to you?
Yeah. So the way I look at it, exactly as you said, from like a first principles perspective, what I found is what I think to be an opportunity, something that opened up more expirations. It's a generally new market. Generally new markets tend to be slightly less efficient until they get full participation. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, I just thought that there would be a lot of slop in the market. Mm-hmm. Even something like SPX, which to be clear is massive. It's a huge product, tons of participants. But on something that has a new offering, even if it's something that's heavily traded, it still will have some slack in the way that they're pricing things and whatnot. So my goal originally was to see what can be done there. Now, from a typical options trading perspective, I tend to break opportunities down into two buckets. Either I'm trading something kind of like you directionally, or I'm trading something in terms of a volatility perspective. And from reviewing a pretty large swath of data, like we were discussing before, you can find persistence of variance risk premia, which is essentially, like we were talking about, the tendency for implied volatility to trend overstated to realized. So that in and of itself can provide an edge if you're able to capture it. It's there. And there's, I think, one of the important components of things like this is to be able to just discreetly summarize why it's there. If you can't really explain why there's variance risk premia, then you're probably missing something. Mm-hmm. So if you think about markets, I would argue definitely not purely efficient, but pretty efficient. And if you think about the number of participants, how sophisticated they are, a rational thinker would say, well, if markets are pretty efficient and that's the case, why? Why would implied volatility be overstated? Why wouldn't it be priced closer to what it should be? And it's a really important question to dive into. And to me, that's really the problem to solve, is to identify this thing that we can clearly observe. It's easy to see that it's there, but then it's to understand why it's there, and then how can we monetize it? So the reason why it's there, multiple fold, there's a lot of components that go into it, but really it boils down to, there are a lot of market participants that want to purchase protection and they're willing to overpay. That's what it comes down to. And that provides opportunity, because if I'm selling options, I'm essentially providing liquidity to somebody. And that's another service to a degree that's being offered, depending on how you choose to enter your positions and make your small markets as a reason. Not really make big markets, but you're still providing a degree of liquidity, because somebody's looking to buy options and you're willing to sell them. And that provides them the ability to execute when they feel like it. So then,
there's two things you said that are just like resonating hardcore, which is one, edge, right? I don't think the market's that efficient on short-term time frame, which is where we're kind of trading here. So I think that's another thing. But the part about basically like an insurance company, like there's premium there because people are protecting themselves either from upside or downside moves. So do you sort of approach that from like, you're the insurer, like, and you're just looking to collect a premium without paying out? Is that kind of your mindset there?
I think it's a reasonable perspective to have. It's not mine personally.
Okay.
I am interested more in trying to trade the relative value of things. So what I do, especially with zero DTEs, is I'll take volatility samples throughout the day, and then I will try to forecast what I think volatility is likely to be throughout the rest of the day. And then if I see that things are trading rich, again, compared to my very rudimentary analysis, then I'm inclined to provide and sell. But the notion of insurance companies, one of the hallmarks of them in general is that they don't really get to be overly discerning. They definitely get to pick to a degree. Like a lot of companies, home insurance out here in California, they're leaving because the market's not productive for them. So they definitely do get a say, but in general, the way insurance companies are making their money is in mass, large swaths of people that come into their network. Then you decide how many of them you're going to have to pay out on, and then obviously price things so that you have a little bit of an edge. So it's completely viable. But the way that I look to trade zero DTEs is a bit more discretionary, and I'm not looking to trade zero DTEs every single day. I trade them most days, at least as of late, because I'm still seeing a lot of opportunity, but I'm mostly interested in gaining exposure when it looks like there's a really good opportunity available.
Gotcha. Interesting. So on the first principles part, one of the things is sort of questioning the assumptions that you may have previously had. And I know, you know, I've yet to find, and maybe because I don't look anymore, but all the option books that I've ever read have this just kind of heavy focus on the Greeks. And even if you're a Tasty Trade kind of person, which I am, I've watched all their stuff. There's something about, and this is my opinion now, a lot of that goes out the window for me when you get down to these more shorter time frames. So that's one of the reasons I've gotten to a shorter and shorter and shorter time frame, is because nobody really knows, right? Which is ultimately why you're doing your own research. And I've been doing my own research about, well, there's an edge in here somewhere. And we're trying to find that through our approaches. But before zero DTEs, is there anything, maybe some concepts that you used to believe that maybe you no longer believe, or maybe you don't really think they apply to, let's say, short-term stuff? Because really, you know, I think it was May 2022 is when five days of expiration has come out. And you mentioned like, hey, there's a new, not that it was a new market, but there were new expirations. And it's like, well, what's that going to do to the other days? And does that even matter? Blah, blah, blah. So we're trying to like kind of figure this out like the rest of the world, but is there anything that's kind of changed or maybe changed your opinion of in kind of in this process?
And just to clarify, are you asking with respect specifically to zero DTEs or to options trading in general?
Just options trading in general. You know, are there some assumptions, and you know, I'm using the word assumptions, but, and I think I'm using the word assumptions because when you read books, you assume that the books are right. Mm-hmm. And maybe they are, right? But it's just like the markets are different now. And I don't think a book from 20 years ago really isn't going to apply unless it's like a textbook on the Greeks and like what it actually is. Yes, it's the same, but the actual application and the way the market participants are using that, I think, are different now. Mm-hmm. So I'm really just kind of asking, like, you know, the more research you do, what are some things that maybe you're throwing out, or maybe they're confirming something for you, you know, that you've always, you know, maybe a long belief you've always held?
Yeah, definitely. That's actually a really interesting question, because when I think about my belief system and its evolution throughout my trading career, it's moved massively. Like literally massively.
Yeah.
In the beginning, a big part of my approach was trying to capture a high win rate. That was important to me. Mm-hmm. And over time, I started to realize that I was winning a whole lot, but the losing positions I had were big. And then I wasn't actually walking away with a bunch of money, even though I had a 70, 80% plus win rate. So I was like, well, yeah, this isn't working out how I thought it would. So in that kind of instance, I found my way into focusing on something called expected returns, or the expectancy of a system. So that's like one top of mind example that immediately pops out at me. That was a massive pivot in what I did, because like most traders, I think none of us enjoy losing, right? It's always kind of annoying. And yeah, in the beginning, as a new trader, I find a lot of new traders, actually myself included, I would place like too much emphasis on the outcome of an individual trade.
Yeah.
And it's because it was a reflection of me. It was a reflection of the research that I did, yeah, the amount of effort I put into learning this skill set. And then even if you do everything right and then it comes out at a negative outcome, then it's like, man, I put in all this work and it still didn't work, yada, yada, yada. And I started to realize that as soon as a trader adopts a process-focused mindset towards trading, and what I try to remind people is, even if you do everything right and you have a losing trade, you still have a losing trade. It's a loss. It's not somehow magically a winner because you followed your plan, but it's okay to have losing positions.
Yeah.
They're part of this broader system where ideally you're going to have tens of thousands of trades as a trader over your life cycle. One trade doesn't matter, literally doesn't matter. But what matters is how well you can consistently execute a strategy. So that's another thing that I think I really pivoted on early on, is I was way too focused on individual trade outcomes. Yeah. And that leads to a whole host of problems. And I think options can be really dangerous in that sense, because you can be so wrapped up in the outcome of an individual transaction and forego the impact that approach can have on the broader system. And that's actually when I had the largest percent drawdown on my trading account year to date. I'd been trading for 5 years at the time. Mm. And I still was so focused on this one individual trade that I placed this really stupid position in rut, and I had to move against me. Long story short, ended up wiping out almost a third of the account on one single trade. And it was one of the most dumbest things I can look at in what I've done as a trader so far.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think
I've been there.
Yeah. And I think is like the most important part in trading, especially in derivatives, is we add complexity and markets change. So even things like the variance risk premium that I was discussing, a belief that I had and continue to have is that it exists, and it's because I can see it. But the magnitude of its existence changes over time as more market participants find their way into markets and things become more efficient. That's actually why there's a handful of things that I do that honestly, like I wouldn't talk to my dog about. And it's because I'm trading in small enough markets that if other people start finding their way in, like it really does have the potential to negatively impact my outcome. Mm-hmm. However, with something like SPX, it doesn't matter. It does not matter, because that's going to be there for, again, the reasons we discussed earlier. But I think it's really important to stay sensitive to how those things are trending. And one other example that I think is evolved over my trading career is a big thing I trade is post earnings announcement drift. It's a pretty well-known market anomaly, and you can clearly track it. However, if you look over the past decade, its existence in large cap stocks has gone down massively. And it's because lots of people know about it now. And it's really decreased the impact of it. Now, NVIDIA aside, because NVIDIA doesn't care right now. Obviously, I'm making a joke there, because even though writ large, there will always be exceptions to these rules. You can have these kind of thesis that you might trade post-earnings announcement drift, typically works. And you can run that for a while. And then you start realizing your results aren't lining up with the way that they should be based on your studies. And then you're like, well, what's going on here? And then you take a closer look and you're like, well, shit. For the last 2 years, the prospective move post earnings that meet all the criteria for PEED, they're not doing it anymore. And then you look a little closer and you're like, well, it's only happening in large caps. Why is that? And exactly like you were alluding to earlier on the first principles process, is you have the kind of ability to look at this thing that you thought was there, analyze it, see a change, and then you have to kind of go back to ground zero. Why does post earnings announcement drift exist? Why would it be changing here? And what can we do about it going forward? So it's probably one of the most interesting topics I can think of as a trader, is to like think about the evolution of those things over time, because it's so easy to find and define a way that you trade and then just continue to do it because you're comfortable with it. You know what it looks like, you know what it produces typically, but then you get fall way by the wayside. And I actually wanted to ask you about your evolution with your focus on price, because like you said, you went through this pretty significant change where you were focused on a bunch of different things. And like we were talking before, you really started honing in on price. So what led you down that route?
Yeah, it's a good question. Thanks for asking. So I had, similar to you, we had done some back testing with options. Our approach was basically like time of day. And so what we would do is we would backtest every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, sell a put credit spread at different deltas, you know, delta 50, 45, 40, 30, 35, all the way down to like 25, something like that. And we would sell credit spreads, put credit spreads every 30 minutes throughout the day. We would sell call spreads every 30 minutes throughout the day. And then we would look at the results and we would say, huh, man, Mondays at 10 made a shit ton of money. Mm. I shouldn't curse on my own podcast. But yeah, so we figured out that there were patterns in profitability. And it was sort of this thing about, it was almost like, I felt like I was getting back into trend following without price. We were following the winning trades. Why does selling put credit spreads Monday at 10 a.m. win 90% of the time when you're selling a delta 45, which should only win, you know, 50% of the time? So it was very clear that this pattern would work for like 2 or 3 months and then it would stop working. And then all of a sudden, you know, it would be Tuesday that would run or Wednesday or whatever. And so we noticed these like profitable patterns from selling options and mostly credit spreads, because we were trying to keep our risk, you know, from blowing up, you know, with 0 day stuff. But, and so instead of trying, so then it was like, okay, I always have to kind of remember, and I was thinking about this today. Let me back up a little bit. Someone in my group this week asked me about options flow. One of the things we look at is options flow, and, you know, we see like, I'm using Unusual Whales right now. I like their market tide, and they added this ETF holdings function where you could just see the options flow for stocks inside the S&P 500. And it's super interesting. They have contract volume. So I've been, you know, we kind of just watch this, because if my system is saying, hey, we should go long today, well, if the option, I kind of look at that as like a sentiment indicator. And if sentiment is agreeing or confirming my price prediction, then I take the trade kind of thing. And so one of the days, calls were above puts, but the market was going down. And the member said, hey, why would the market go down if calls are being bought and, calls are being bought and puts are being sold? And it was a great question. I mean, I don't know, right? But it got back to like options are a derivative of an underlying. And so no matter what that, whatever you think that option is going to do, it's still going to, it's going to react to the price. And I want, everyone needs to just kind of remember that, that yes, in the world of AMC and GME, there are times where the tail wags the dog and you can get kind of a feedback loop of hedging that happens ultimately where, you know, if you're getting a ton of calls being bought and market makers have to hedge by buying stock, it can create sort of this loop that, you know, but in SP, that'll never happen with SPX. Calls are not going to lead a huge index like that, or, you know, so it's always a derivative. And so going back to the, you know, options research, we're like, okay, well, why? And I just remember Monday and Friday were like the best days to sell put credit spreads for, you know, a long time before COVID, right? And it was like, well, why is that? That means that ultimately, if you sell a put spread at 9 or at, you know, 10 o'clock Eastern, you know, 30 minutes after the open, that means a big majority of the time price has to close higher or at least has to make some kind of move up that way. So I was like, all right, well, let me, you know, I came up with this, you know, for lack of a better term, intraday seasonality mechanism to, I wanted to see that in the price, right? And
I actually think that's the perfect term, by the way.
Yeah. And that's what it is. It's intraday seasonality.
I think it's a perfect term.
And we found that once I got that in place, I was doing it in Excel and kind of sharing my charts with some members and stuff. And it was just like, wow, the market does go up on Mondays until it doesn't, right? And then all of a sudden it doesn't. And then you're wrong. So it's like, you know, there's these cycles where like it's trend following. Mondays will be bullish for like 2 months. And then all of a sudden, then it's Friday or whatever. And what I noticed, and I've been doing this for a couple of years now, when the bear market came, what made money for the longest time was selling put spreads on Mondays because the market tend to rally early in the week and then sell off towards the end of the week, which logically makes sense because people don't want to hold risk over the weekend. So they're hedging or selling or whatever in a bear market. So you were actually able to sell. One of the most consistent strategies at that time was selling put spreads on Monday morning in a bull market with like 2 to 3 days expiration. And so it's like, there's a lot of these things that just don't, they don't make sense from maybe from an options perspective. But when you go back to price, and here's one of the things I always kind of stick with credit spreads. And I know there's a lot of discussion about that, about the risk reward and stuff. But if you, so Thinkorswim has this cool function, which you probably aware that you can change the option chain to be a vertical spread. So instead of just a list of options, you can say, hey, I want to look at verticals, and it'll show you the combined price of verticals up and down the chain. And then you can say, well, what is this going to be at expiration? And when you do that, if let's say a 5-wide spread, every 5-wide spread will be worth $5 if it's in the money. And every 5-wide spread will be worth nothing if it's out of the money. And there's going to be one spread that's somewhere in between, because obviously price will close between two strikes at some point. So the idea here was like, okay, when you 0 day, you know, 1 day, whatever. The idea was, if I know the market has a tendency to close higher than it opened over the last 2 months or whatever it is, then I want to make sure I'm selling on the downside, and that because if it goes higher, then my options will go to zero. And so it's, so I, you know, it's like getting on the, you know, the right side of the market, but in a risk defined way, to where when I'm wrong, which is, you know, it happens a lot when you, you know, you go through cycles. Oh, I have 8 winners and then 3 losers. It's been like 3 days, right? Like it's just like, it's not like you have to wait a month for it to play out. So that's kind of how, that's kind of why I got back into price, because when you do credit spreads, you really negate a lot of the Greeks. You know, the tighter your spread is, I think the more price matters, where if you're selling naked options, like let's say a tasty trade, like, oh, you're selling 45 day puts delta 30 naked, well, you're gonna, the theta, all the concept behind theta is going to apply way more than selling a tight spread that's that far out, because you're negating the theta with your protection. So I think your choice in what you want to trade, like credit spreads or straddles or whatever the thing is, like that's got to be part of your process or strategy, because the options will, option positions, the way they're constructed, will behave differently than something else would. So there's a positioning or a strike selection, like even like where you hang out on the chain. If you hang out farther on the chain, you're probably going to want, and you're selling, you probably want to have some sort of stop going on. But if you're selling at the money, like where I tend to sell is right at the money, and I'm either going to be right or wrong, but my risk reward is actually, it's not quite 1-to-1, but it's close enough. And I just need a win rate of 60-something% to make money. So there's a lot of little elements there. But that was a long way, kind of a long story about getting back into price and just trying to be on the most probable side of that.
I think one of the really impactful things though, about what you're talking about is the way that you stumbled across it, and that you kind of had
stumble's
your original
a good word.
Yeah, it's, but I honestly think that's how most of us come across a lot of these things, is that you take the time to build an original approach, an original idea. And then what you did is, I actually think really noteworthy for people if they didn't key into it, which is you continued analyzing, right? And that's kind of when you came across this, oh, interesting trend I see, where on Tuesdays or Mondays or Wednesdays, this continues to work out. Let's see if we can ride that until the wheels fall off.
Yeah.
And that's the other question I wanted to ask you, and I think is really important for the audience to hear, because sometimes I think people, again, become too focused on the outcome of an individual position. But you can also become too focused on the forever efficacy of something. And like with most things in life, I find there's a balance, right? So you're finding these opportunities that are semi-persistent, but then they roll off. So how did you frame your approach when you were coming across these different opportunities that at first they seem to exist, but then you start to identify that they end up leaving, and then you kind of have to shift a little bit? How did you approach setting that up?
That's a great question. First of all, nothing lasts forever. I hate to say it, but we're all just trend following, I think, at some point in some fashion, where a true options trader would balk at the idea of trend following, I think, because they're, you know, when you get caught up in volatility and stuff, you may not be thinking about that as much. But
just to clarify that anyways, even if you're trading volatility, there's still a trend. You're just trading
a different
trend.
Totally. Yeah. You're not, but most traders wouldn't say that. Like, you're probably the first one I've heard say, oh, I'm trading trends and volatility. I haven't really heard that. I've heard, oh, high vol, mean reversion, but a trend in volatility, it's actually kind of strange to me, because I think of, you know, my default think of volatility is like a spike when something bad happens. But I know there's a lot more nuance there, which is kind of what you're fleshing out. But to go back to your question about like when to know when it stops? Is that what the question is? Or sorry, I've got
no, it's okay. It's part of the question. What I'm really interested in is you've identified something that you know stops at some point, but you still baked into your approach a method to adjust to it when it stops and keep taking advantage of the same market force, more or less, even though it's not the same exact day of the week.
Right.
So that adaptability, I think, is something that traders should learn a little bit more about.
Yeah. So good question. On the intraday seasonality indicator, basically where I ended up with is I look at four weeks of data. I started with six, and six was too slow to react to like a trend shift. And so I found 4 weeks, 1 month to be a pretty good forecaster. And there's different terms here, time series forecasting, that type of thing. Mine's pretty rudimentary. When I talk, I try to talk to some data guys and like they just talk way over my head. I feel like I'm a blue collar math guy, but
I love that, a blue collar math guy.
Yeah, it's like it either works or it doesn't. Like I don't need 50 pages on it, buddy. Okay. Anyway, so people hate me for that, all that, because I didn't like, I'm an IT guy, right? Like I'm not a finance guy, but
but I actually really love that, because
yeah,
I come from a slightly different approach where I truly am like completely obsessed about all of the details, and I literally will spend tens of thousands of hours like sorting it out. And for a lot of people, they're honestly way more aligned with you, where it's like, yeah, okay, dude, like I know that you're a nerd, but just tell me what I need to know. Yeah. So I actually think your approach is way more pragmatic than mine. Better return on your time for sure.
Well, you know, it took me 15, whatever years to get to that point, because ultimately I got to the part where like, this is just so complicated. And it's like, am I that smart to where I can keep up with this? It kind of reminds me of being in my IT field. Like when I started in IT, which was like early 2000s, I was a program, like I was a Cisco networking guy. I could program routers and switches. I kind of moved up. Eventually stuff came out of the, command prompt and got into a GUI. Right. And then, then everything was in a web browser. And so as I got older, it was just like, am I going to be able to do this? And I was in my 40s, I guess. And I just remember thinking, am I going to be able to keep up with the next generation of cybersecurity or whatever? And you know, Power BI, PowerShell was becoming a thing. And like, there was and it was just like so many things. And I was just like, man, I don't know. Like I need to be able to, like what I'm working on right now, can I do this in 5 years? Right. I'm older than you. Right. And, you know, I got kids, like my kids are in, my son's in high school, my daughter's in middle school, like there's stuff going on. Right. So it's like, how much time and attention can I do this? Can I be 65 years old and trade zero DTE, you know, or like, what's it going to be in 10 years or whatever it is? And so it just got to be where like, okay, I need the simplest way. I just need an edge that I can execute and that I can scale if I want. And that's it. And so that's just kind of what I did. And, you know, kind of back to the original question about, you know, finding the right, like when, you know, when is it going to stop working, and how did you kind of manage that? And it kind of comes down to backtesting, you know, there's a combination of, you know, backtesting against a good set of data, understanding what you're backtesting against. I think this is something that a lot of people struggle with. And when, like, the strategy we've been implementing has done really well this in May. And the research came out in early May, started implementing middle May. Everything works fine. We got lucky. And this goes back to something you said earlier. you go to implement a new strategy. Let's say you do all this back test, like, oh, 60, 70% win rate, and I'm average winner is this and average loser is that. And then you start to implement and your first five trades are losers. And the first thing you're going to do is like, this system sucks. I don't know what happened. But it really, like you said, it has nothing to do with that one individual trade. Now, we got lucky. We had like nine, I should have had 10 winners. I had 9 out of 10 winners this past month with this strategy. It was almost painful because taking the next trade, I was like, this is going to be the loser. I don't know what was worse, losing in the beginning, going, okay, the winner's coming, and you kind of like are hopeful, or you're like, oh my God, I'm, you know, we keep winning. When is this going to end? It was like, you're always in that boat, right? Like, is the next one going to be a winner, or is the next one going to be a loser? And after, it's that rule, you know, you ever sit at a roulette table and you get 7, 10, 15 blacks in a row, and you just got to bet red. You know what I mean? So, but that's not right. That's not right. But that's what happens. Cause you know, like, you just know that that's going to be a thing. So, like, you know, when you get, you know, when it goes back to like implementing the strategy, I've done the math. My back test had 182 trades, which over the course of 15 months, it was back tested from 2023 to now. I fully understand 2022 was a bear market. So when that type of environment comes, I know that this probably isn't going to work then, right? So I think it's important that you understand the markets you test against, and like, and it's, you know, the lack of a better term here is multi-time frame analysis. Like, if you're, especially with the 0-day stuff, if you're doing 1-minute data, I still think it matters if you're in a bull market or not, right? Because it just doesn't, the market doesn't go down like it goes up. It's way easier to make money on the upside. I haven't even, someone asked me the other day, because everything we've been doing is selling put spreads, basically. And they're like, well, what about call spreads? And the market's hitting a new all-time high. And part of me is just like, why would you care? Why would you care about shorting the market right now? Like, what? Why? Right? Like, why would you want to do that? And if you're...
You know exactly why, right?
What's your take on that? Why do people... Here's the question. Why do people want to trade as much on the long side as they do the short side? I guess that's my question. Why is that?
Reframe that one for me. Sorry.
Why do people want to trade both sides?
Oh, to me, I think that's the beauty of trading. Like, I personally wouldn't bother trading options too much if that weren't part of the trade-off of trading them. I think being able to trade both sides is really what makes derivatives kind of magical. I think to your point though, I think the act of trying to blindly trade both sides and fade something that's showing a lot of strength is because different learning platforms and different learning sources. And to be clear, like, I'm a big fan. I don't follow tastytrade that close anymore myself, mm-hmm. but like, I know Tom, I talk to him pretty regularly. So he's actually coming, I've made content with him before. And so I respect what they're doing, but one of the things is like, Tom from the tastytrade world is very much a contrarian. Yeah. And I've asked him, I was just like, why are you like this?
And do you listen to his podcast, his Wednesday podcast?
Not really. No,
you should. It's pretty good.
I definitely should. Yeah.
Truth or Skepticism with Dylan Radigan. It's a good podcast. I won't listen to it for like a month, and then I'll just knock him out. And it's good. I like
yeah,
him.
Yeah. That's awesome. And I respect his opinion a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like the main thing that he does though, that I think a lot of people attempt to emulate is to be a contrarian. If something is high, you fade it. But if you ask Tom why he's a contrarian, He has a very specific answer that makes a lot of sense for his background. He was a market maker. So his entire job was to blindly take the other side of your trade. And that's literally exactly what he told me.
Yeah.
So I asked him, because like I was joking with him on his position in NVIDIA, because I was long in NVIDIA. And he was getting murdered because NVIDIA was just running up.
Yeah.
And I was just like, where are you short in here? And I forgot. I think he was short at like the high fours. And it was like at nine something. I was just like,
yeah,
man. That's and he's funny. Like, well, it shouldn't be this, you know, that going down that whole route. And I was just like, interesting. But
well, let me clarify something here. When I say, why would you consider shorting the market? Tom is not necessarily shorting the market. He's shorting the volatility of that direction. So it's not like he's shorting NVIDIA and getting blown out. He's probably selling calls like way above that's outside the expected move or something. So to me, I think there's a difference between shorting volatility, if you want to call it that, or let's say mean reversion or whatever, versus like shorting. So, and this goes back to what we're doing. Like we're selling at the money stuff where price has to go up or down. And when price is in an up mode, like I just not interested in selling at the money call spreads. And even Iron Condor, I mean, I do Iron Condors too, usually like 2 weeks out. And that can work, right? But I wouldn't consider selling Iron Condors or maybe selling call spreads 30 days out at Delta 20 or whatever. To me, that's not shorting the market. I meant more like directional. And the reason why I say this, when you backtest, and you've probably seen this before, if you have some kind of signal that's like, hey, if this bullish condition exists, go long. Well, if you backtest that for 5 years, like you're going to get 1,000 trades. And then if you said, okay, well, do the same thing, but this time short, you're not going to get 1,000 trades. You're going to get 100 trades. So then you have to be honest with yourself and say, is this sample size, can I go in with the same amount of confidence as this 1,000 trade, you know, back test versus this 100 trade sample size that, yeah, it did awesome in COVID, right? For 2 months, it did awesome. And then you got your face ripped off. And then you're like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not equal, like from a directional
I agree with you. I can't speak specifically for Tom, right? Because he put the trade on.
I'm sure.
But I actually would argue that is the structure of that trade is entirely directional. Because if you have something going up and you sell something against it, the entire premise of that trade is that it's going to stop going up at some point. So to me, I think it definitely has aspects of volatility, but the like a short call also in no way actually isolates volatility. So that trade will still predominantly be like you found with a lot of your trading. That's still going to be predominantly exposed to direction. But the main point anyways, going back to the
you think that's an ego trade?
I don't think it's necessarily an ego trade. I think it's for Tom in the way that he works, like in his mind, because Tom, I genuinely don't believe he has a ton of an ego. He does, like we all do, and he has like his opinions. So I think the way that he managed that trade was an ego move, meaning that, you know, he thought it was going to go down. Because to me, if I sell a call and my thesis is it goes down, and then you literally get ran over by 100% from your entry, like, you can't be more wrong. Like that's, it's as wrong as you can get. So to me, like I would have had an exit point way earlier than that. So I think part of that becomes a little bit of a resistance on his point to, you know, just play it out and see where it goes. But I think the thesis of trading price like that is not necessarily an ego. I actually think though, it's such a dangerous approach for retail traders. Such a dangerous approach.
Well, I don't think he recommends that. You know, I think he
doesn't.
He'll share what he's doing, but
exactly.
I think he, not to kind of turn to him, but like, I think he just, there's something about like sports gambling, which I don't really do, but it's like the only example I really have is like the Super Bowl, right? and someone brings out the squares, and all of a sudden you're interested because you have 7 and 3, and you're like, oh, well, if one team kicks a field goal and the other one with a touchdown, I might win the first quarter $20 or whatever it is, right? And so I think he likes to dabble with insignificant position size with some of that. And some of that I get from what he says on his podcast, because he'll talk about some of these positions where he's like, ah, it's not enough, but yeah, I'm short, but yeah, it's not really a meaningful type of thing. But I think there's something about participating. It's like a game for him, you know?
Definitely.
Which is cool.
Yeah. Somebody like him, he's a pure junkie on this stuff, which is cool. I agree with you. Like, it's actually very, very cool to see that in a trader. But I think from like a retail trading perspective, like you're talking about, I think the idea for a trader to want to try to short something that's going up comes a lot from them hearing either from Tasty or indirectly through other avenues, where it's like the idea, it sounds really smart, right? And that's, I find traders do that all the time with things that sound so smart, but then they don't actually understand the implications of it. Again, perfect example, high win rates. If you look at high win rate in a vacuum, it literally sounds so smart. Who wouldn't want to have a massively high win rate?
Yeah.
Until you look at the math on it and you realize, well, shit, I could actually lose way more and make more money, but I don't want to lose. So to me, part of that is traders executing things that they've heard in places that seem really intelligent without fully comprehending the context of it. Now, there are other scenarios there, right? So like maybe you have that trader and they decide that they want to short the market while it's going up because they have a bunch of really long deltas in the rest of their portfolio that they think are getting extended, and they're looking to apply some sort of broad portfolio hedge. You wouldn't really use spreads for that. But anyways, just giving another idea that where it could be slightly more logical. But I find very frequently traders are all too willing to step in front of moving trains, either up or down, because they think that they're smarter than the market, that they know something that the rest of the market does, that they're, well, this seems too extended here for me, so let me fade it. And I always think, like your reaction to that original question from them, I always think like what in this breadth of evidence that we're looking at right now shows us that this is too extended and should reverse as compared to continue on the path it's been exhibiting for X period of time. Now, to be clear, sooner or later, everything will roll over. And that's actually a really great tradable event. But what I offer to people is wait until it starts to do what you want. You're not going to top tick things and you're not going to bottom tick things, meaning catch the exact pivots, but you're going to get ran over a whole lot less.
Yeah. I don't mean to sound like that's a dumb question or anything, because
no, it's not,
especially in the context of when I'm talking about this. The question I got this week was, it was more about I think there's an element of FOMO, and I think there's an element of, and I used to be like this when I first started. One of the things about trading options was, oh, you can make money when the market goes down, which was like, oh my God, that's crazy. And it was kind of like, if you could do that and you could tell your friends, hey, I made whatever when the stock crashed, like you would just be cool, right? No matter if it was $50 or $500 or whatever. And so that element of cool, I definitely don't have that anymore. Like, nobody cares, right? For me. But when you first start out and you're telling all your friends what you're learning about, it's like, I think people just itch to make that money on the downside, right? Because they're the only ones like I'm the only one of all my friends that do anything like this. Right. And so when you're the only one in the group and you're able to say something, I think there's an ego thing to me. I know that because I used to think like that when I first started out, because I was trading both sides. I usually lost on the short side, but every now and then I'd get that one and be like, oh yeah, I made money when it crashed, but not, you know.
But honestly, that's fascinating to me because I can totally follow that train of thought. To be complete, like, it's 100% foreign to me. I've never actually thought like that before, but I could absolutely see that in play. It's honestly like a really great highlight for people, because I think sometimes like those smaller subconscious things can be at play and actually have way more of an impact on what we're doing than we might even acknowledge. Like that might be the kind of thing that maybe I was thinking that and I didn't even acknowledge it. Honestly, most of my friends are not really good with money. My biggest win with one of my friends was getting him to not put $20 in a bar jukebox at one point. That was my big win. So we're not really talking about making money in markets with those people, but nonetheless, I love them all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and the other element is, this is something I struggle with, so I get it. But like, so we were trading these spreads this past month and had a really good win streak. We update the data. Now it's, the data is telling us, hey, don't trade it for a few days. And so this, we've been kind of sitting on hands a little bit this week, and the system was right. The market has rolled over. We are no longer long, and getting excited about that, I think, is getting excited about not trading. I was so excited today when the market, like we, so just for the listeners, we're doing this, was it May 30th, and the market rolled over before CPI, and I had a trade ready. I've been doing some bot stuff. It's been pretty cool. And it was like, there was a moving average thing. It has to be above this level. If it's above, I'm going to turn the bot on. Well, I was back and forth with the bot all day, and then ultimately it rolled over. So I turned the bot off. So I ended up working, if you want to call it that, and didn't take a trade. And I think like, it's taken me a long time to be like, awesome. Like I followed the system. I'm not going to be participating tomorrow when the market gaps up or down, which could be, you know, could be good or bad, but I'm excited that I'm just excited that we got out and the market rolled over. Like that to me is just like, we did it. Right. We were long. We were going long for a few weeks. We caught the run up. We followed the system, and now we're waiting because the market is, you know, quote unquote, pulling back. And then we just wait for the next signal. I don't have any signals that would have told us this is when it's going to roll over. Just because it's telling you not to go long doesn't mean it's time to go short. It just means to not go long. And so I think there's some nuances there that and maybe that's, you know, now that I'm talking this through is maybe that's what this person was sort of asking in a, you know, roundabout way. It's like, okay, we're not going long. Should we short? And the answer is no, we shouldn't short. Those are two different, you don't always have to be in the market, I guess. Hey, do you not trade a lot? Are there times that you don't trade? Because I know there's some, you know, or you always... Are you in it every day, like from a zero?
I pretty much always have stuff on zero DEs. Like we were talking about before, I'm pretty discretionary. So very specific conditions have to be met in order for me to enter. And for me, like zero DTEs is a small part of my book. Yeah. I like them because you get to trade them a lot. They're fun. I get to learn a lot about markets and, you know, the way that they behave with products like that, which I just find intellectually curious. But yeah, it's not something that I would force myself to enter on any specific cadence if the criteria was set. So I very much mirror a lot of what you do there. In terms of like my broader book, I almost always have positions on. If I look over the past decade and a half, there's, I mean, less than double digit periods where I've been completely flat. One of them I'm pretty sure was in COVID. And I think another one was in, what was it, 22? I think those are the two recent instances where I had at least some period where I was completely flat, but it's super.
Yeah. Well, I'm rarely completely flat, but when it comes to like 0 day, 1 day, I'm flat a lot. I wait until, you know, I'm trying to get better about, I'm trying to be less discretionary, I guess, in that sense. You know, which is why I've implemented, I started using Whisper Trades, which is a kind of an automation software. It doesn't really do the analysis you want to do. So you kind of have to like turn your bot on when you want. It's kind of a, it's like semi-automated, I guess, depending on your
still
strategy.
Still semi-discretionary because, you have to decide when it's on.
Yeah, but somehow I landed on like, okay, if I can just take the, if I can just make the entry, if I can just get consistent at the entry mechanically, I think that'll be better as a, and really try to stick to like, we have like times of day that we kind of adhere to a lot for some of this stuff. And so it's like all the research I did was at 3:45 PM from a consistent entry standpoint. So it's like, I want to take this trade at 3:45, not 3:43, 3:45. Cause then I could at least say I'm doing exactly what, you know, and I have the bot. It's even the bot will, the bot's cool because it will, I'll have a minimum premium that I want. I have a delta for the strike and I have a window of time. And sometimes it waits and it'll adjust the strikes. Cause you think about like, okay, I want to sell a delta 48 option. Well, there might not be a 48. There's going to be a 52 and a 44. And if it goes lower, it won't get the credit I want, right? If it goes higher, I'll get too much credit. And it's outside the scope. So I've kind of figured out this little combination to where it'll just wait. And then obviously price isn't going to sit there. Price will move up or down. And then I may get, and eventually it'll fill. If I was trading that manually, I would just pick and choose to get it over with, right? I'd be like, I just want to get in this and be done, right? So I would end up maybe choosing strikes that weren't, and we're talking like a few points, so it's probably not that big of a deal. But it just helps. I don't know. There's something about it. That's kind of what I've been working on, and that's been going pretty well. But
yeah, well, and I think especially for that kind of system, like that approach makes a lot of sense too, because you're essentially using the automation just to offload some of the very manual work. And to me, I see no reason why that wouldn't be efficacious for what you're trying to do, especially like to be like really specific on the entries and whatnot. Because to your point, I actually think that's a really important factor, is to be supremely consistent, especially if you're trying to model anything after back tested data. Otherwise you run into a massive problem where if you're running your test at, you know, like you said, 1545, and then you're sometimes putting the trade on at 1100, like, that's a massively different scenario.
Yeah.
So you can't with any sort of efficacy assess how well that system is doing if you're not adhering to it. So I think that you found a really effective way to find something that works, but then also implement it. But it's interesting because you're kind of like a cyborg in that you still have like your human element, but then also the assist element, which that's actually really, really cool, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. I mean, I know there's some other trade automation softwares. I know Option Alpha's got a pretty robust system, but they don't offer SPX. And do you know why they don't offer SPX?
Mm-hmm. I actually just did an interview with Kirk not too long ago.
Oh,
we got to that. It's because of the
increments, right? The nickel wide.
So exactly. Cause everything about what they've built essentially is built on penny wide.
I mean, don't you think they should just build the SPX one? It's like the most like traded, I don't know, maybe not the most traded, probably SPY is, but they should hire a guy just for that. Because then I would switch to them because they can do the other conditions that I'm humanly, like today, like it was a crapshoot as to whether or not I was going to enter the trade. And it was like 5 minutes before, maybe 10 minutes before, and I still didn't know. And I was like, hey, nope. And then it faded. And if I just had that part automated, which I can't do in the current platform, then I could truly just let it go. Cause then what started creeping in are thoughts about, well, options flow is very bearish. Core PCE inflation is tomorrow. I've already had 10 winners in a row, and like all these things started creeping in, like I should just not take this trade. I'm going to get some popcorn and whatever, watch it tomorrow. But I followed it, ended up not taking the trade, but I'm like secretly relieved, right? That I didn't have to take that trade. So it's so weird. It's like a weird thing.
Yeah, that one's really interesting too. Cause I actually think the process of like offloading the emotionality of trading is really dangerous. I think arriving at like really efficacious self-regulation is probably the true answer in general. But I could see how in your kind of scenario, as you're outlining that kind of general like emotional roller coaster that you are able to navigate through, but that's still difficult to navigate through for people and to arrive at the correct conclusion. I think something like automation can help with some of it, but for me, I would be concerned if that's kind of putting a Band-Aid on a wound that kind of requires stitches.
Yeah.
And if a closer self-analysis has to, because like for me, I can fully envision and empathize with that thought process. But the way that I think about those kinds of things is if I don't do or follow the process now in this one circumstance, even if it works out, I've now digressed because now the propensity to void it again for another anomaly in the future becomes even more appetizing, and then so on and so forth. And I always bring myself back. This is just one trade in a series of thousands.
Yeah.
If the correct scenario is there, if this is the 11th trade and the 11th is a loser, doesn't matter, because on top of these 11 that I've had, I'm going to see 20,000 more over the X time frame. So for me, I always try to bring it back to that process. At least for me, that's kind of how I've navigated it. Because as you were talking about that, I literally couldn't empathize with you more. We've all been there, right? Yeah. It's always just this series of stuff going on that a trader has to develop a healthy relationship with at some point. And like you said, like you were able to navigate it. I imagine a lot of people probably would have had a different outcome because they might not be as well versed as you in terms of negotiating it. So I think it's cool.
I'm laughing. I just, you know, I quit my corporate job like 4 years ago, to trade full time and develop my strategies. And I built this app and stuff. And there's been a lot of times lately that I wish I didn't have. And wish is a strong word. There's a lot of times lately that having a day job would have been better. Because a lot of this, one of the things I started doing when in my testing was I used to test like 50%, taking profits at 50%, or, you know, managing winners. That's, you know, and it's kind of goes, I know we're all over the place, but this goes back to the first principles of like questioning some assumptions or maybe things you've learned. And, you know, managing winners was something, a big thing I learned from Tasty Trade. And in a lot of cases, what they're teaching, it's true, right? Like if you're trading 30 to 45 days out, it does make sense to take profits at 50%, recycle the capital, yada, yada, yada. But
that's one of the things that you and I were talking about before, though. That's really interesting, right? Because
But I don't think it's the same for...
Well, I think in general, the process of managing winners is really attractive, but it feeds bad habits.
Yeah.
One terrible habit it feeds is we fall further and further into different selective bias in our minds. And one of them is the disposition effect, where we really want to realize winning trades, and we tend to realize them too fast. And this is from a study called The Behavior of Individual Investors. Everybody can look it up on SSRN. It's by Barbara Lean and O'Dean from the University of California. And one of the propensities is for traders writ large to want to realize winning positions and to let losers run. So if we set up a scenario where we're realizing winners, again, it kind of feeds that. I'm not saying it's a direct problem. I think the bigger problem there is that you have to analyze what the result is on the total profitability, because from the Tasty Trade perspective, they know a lot of their clientele have smaller accounts. They know a lot of their clientele will have that kind of cognitive bias, and they know a lot of their clientele won't necessarily want to have massive P&L volatility. However, you have to look at the X trades that you've taken in terms of X being a number and see of those that hit your 50% max profit, how many go on to be 100% max profit.
Yeah.
And it can be a lot of them.
Yeah.
So I think there's no, you know, discrete right or wrong answer, but I can tell you the wrong answer is to just automatically go to take profits. Mm-hmm. You can, I remind people of this all the time. You literally can go broke taking profits, contrary to what you've heard. Yeah. People will say you can't go broke taking profits, because here's the thing. Sooner or later, risk is going to be realized, meaning you're going to have a losing position. We all do. There's no escaping it. And if that losing position is too large compared to your winning positions, because you got in the habit of taking a bunch of tiny little wins to realize them all, you now have a problem. So again, I'm not saying it's good or bad to manage profits. It's really dependent on the system. But what's bad is to default to that as compared to analyzing it. So but sorry, I completely cut you off. I just thought spurred that entire thought that we were talking about that before.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I've just seen this with pretty much every strategy that I've traded or tested and adjusted. I've changed, and maybe this gets into backtesting. I've sort of changed my backtesting mentality, if you will, where I want to identify the edge. And let me back up a little bit. I run a website called Alpha Crunching, where we identify price and probability of something closing higher or lower over the next couple of days or whatever. So when I'm backtesting against that, I don't want the profit taking to be the edge, right? Like I want my edge to be more pure.
Being alone, yeah.
I don't want my edge to be a stop. I don't want my edge, because backtesting stops is like good luck, right? Like I don't trust any of that. So when I backtest now, I want to say, hey, look, like, and this is something we've been doing in my group, and there's been some different takes on this from some of the guys I trade with. And nothing's wrong here or right. You ultimately get into what you want to deal with. But if you let it go to expiration, yes, your winners will not be eaten up as much when you finally do get that loser, no matter what strike you're choosing. I do think strike selection is part of the edge. I don't think profit taking or stops is part of the edge, at least for what I'm doing, because I'm selling at the money. Most of my stuff is 3-2 risk reward. So one loser would eat up 1.5 winners. So it's pretty, you know, not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. But if I profit take, if I have a 3-2 risk reward and I profit take at 50%, now I have a 3-1 risk reward and my win rate goes up, but my overall profitability goes down. That's okay. If you look at the P&L curve, and it's smoother, sometimes that's the case, you know, but if you want to make more money, quote unquote, more money, then sometimes letting it go. But my risk reward is so close that I should, and this is what I'm struggling with, I should be able to let that go. But because I'm so smart, right, and I watch the market, like I outsmart myself by closing early. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about is discretionary exits. And I wanted to maybe get your thought on this, where you're like, okay, we have a system, quote unquote system. You do this, you let it go to expiration. But when you're trading like very like FOMC or tomorrow's core inflation, how do you factor those things into your trading? Do you avoid those? Do you wait till they're over? Or are you, you know, do you treat it like an earnings event where you're expecting something afterwards or whatever? What's your take on sort of adding discretionary elements to maybe a system that you're working on?
Yeah, I think it depends a lot on the system, but fortunately for things like CPI, FOMC, there's a large data set available on them. So I actually have a pretty large data set for how markets behave around those kinds of events. It's the same thing I do for earnings. I never would trade an earnings release in a company in a vacuum. I'll always look at the past 12 and I'll see how it's behaved. So it's the same thing I'll do tomorrow. It's definitely not no-go criteria, but the options need to be priced appropriately in order for the risk to be worthwhile. But I think the inclusion of like discretion really comes still on zero DTE stuff, at least for me, because like I said, a big part of what I do is I take like real-time data sample or volatility samples. to get a sense of like, how much is this thing moving? And then I actually have a chart that I've built for myself that says, you know, based on this kind of volatility sample, this is the frequency that the rest of the day behaves like this or this or this. And I just kind of create like a probabilistic assessment of, based on the vol sample that I have, what could it do? But then I also always have to overlay the nuance of whatever's happening that individual day that may or may not be, you know, captured in the vol sample. So yeah. I think basing the decision on data is probably the most important part. But if you have good reason to believe that, you know, whatever you're trying to gain exposure to doesn't necessarily, it's not captured effectively in your data sample, then for me, I would forego, because then you're just, you're taking a step out into the wide open, hoping that things still continue to hold up. And again, for specifically things like zero DTEs, tons of opportunity. So yeah. Let's say, for example, you're a trader, you don't really know how it moves around CPI, you're not comfortable with your data set, whatever the case is. For me, I would literally just say, I'll just literally wait and see how it goes. And then either if it's behaving in line and the market's not freaking out and I'm comfortable with that condition or whatever. But I don't think that there's necessarily some sort of compulsion to like force an entry on everything, especially if it's not something that you have at least some semblance of an idea of how it might impact markets.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I know like zero day is its own thing, I think, because what happens that day really matters. But I know like everything else, for the most part, back testing, it's unaware of all those things. And I was going to ignore it today. I was ready to take that trade today, even though inflation's tomorrow, but the signal or whatever, the condition failed. So I wasn't in, but we have to wrap it up, but I want to go kind of wrap it up with first principles. Man, we've been going almost 2 hours. The last thing of, you know, once you come up with your solution to, you know, the way you're trading, testing and iterating are kind of like where you end up. And I just wanted to see how you sort of keep your systems up to date, because I'm pretty sure that you're not going to be like, oh, this is it, I'm done, and you just trade moving forward with the same thing. Like, what's your test and iterate process and maybe frequency that you're doing?
Yeah. So depending on the strategy, I have kind of a rolling data set that I'll ingest and use. But the short concept in terms of testing broadly is I like to start with the largest data set possible that I can find for whatever it is I'm trying to look at. So great example, CPI coming out tomorrow. So I will literally try to find market data around CPI going back as far as I can find it. Then I will test something or theory around that entire condition. Then I will start to segment the data, which I think is a really important process, because if you just look at a really broad data sample, it gets rid of all nuance. It smooths the path immensely. So for example, this is a great example that people might be able to connect with more directly. If you look at buy and hold in TQQQs and 3x leveraged Qs ETF, if you look at buy and hold in that over a long enough time frame, it looks fantastic, makes a ton of money. If you look at the path it takes, it'll have 90% drawdowns in it.
Yeah.
How ready are you to watch your entire wealth evaporate by 90% in the execution of the strategy, right? The path matters a lot. So when we segment data, we learn about the path. So let's say we have a 10-year period we're analyzing. I typically will rate the weight, the more recent results, as compared to data that I'm testing from the 20s. I'll still look at it, but I don't weight it the same. Then I'll segment. So let's say we have a 10-year period, I'll break it into 2 5-year periods, run the same exact test. Then I'll break it in 5 2-year periods, run the same exact test. And then I'll literally break it into single year periods. And I will get a complete understanding of the path that whatever the rule set is that I'm looking at and how that behaves. And you can't tweak the rule sets as you're changing the sample size. So I typically run them in parallel. I'll come up with whatever rule set I think makes sense. For example, TQQQs, I want to buy it when it's above the 50-day moving average. pretty simple. Right. So then I'll find the conditions that that happens. And then maybe I'll say, well, I want to exit when it goes below the 50. And then maybe I'll test if it goes below the 22. And then maybe if it goes below the 11, whatever. Like, you could pick whatever things make sense to you. Because even if what you look at makes no sense and it doesn't look good at all, you've still learned something. You now know that that specific input doesn't really make sense and it doesn't apply. And you now have a usable data point going forward on what to focus on. So I think the big thing is big data set segmenting, having an organized approach where you're actually tracking the results so that you can compare them very easily. If anybody's ever seen any of like my zero DTE analysis videos where I'm kind of sharing some of the back testing and whatnot that I do, I essentially just super simple, put it in Excel, but I put it in a format that it's so easy for me to compare everything. Because if it's kind of like fragmented, you have to look at a screenshot there, you got a note over there, your data is completely useless and you can't really do much with it. So I think the entire idea of testing is really born out of trying to see the performance of a hypothesis. I think one of the most important things traders that have, they have to be so careful of when you start going through this testing thing is this concept called overfitting.
Yeah.
So if you think about a time series or, you know, just a time frame, and you look at the data plotted across the time series, and if your results essentially perfectly match the data set, you're grossly overfit. And what that means is going forward, as markets naturally deviate, you probably are going to get eviscerated because you've now fit this entire approach to a series of conditions that only occurred in this perfect vacuum that will never happen again, just like that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that is really important to track is the robustness of your data. And by segmenting it, that's how you can test it. You can see the standard deviation of the results across the segmented periods. And that gives you a pretty good understanding. If you see something with zero standard deviation, it means that you've overfit it to a T. It means that this is not usable going forward likely. But if you see something with massive variance, it means that you probably need to add a little bit more controls to it because your results are all over the place.
So yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, the process of testing, as you could tell, is super fun because you have an opportunity to take all these ideas you have and see how they perform. But there's some general best practices like that to make sure that you don't go down the wrong path.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I've tried to mention my backtesting before. It's like, I just want to kind of identify the edge because like you said, and here's a good example, selling call spreads in a bear market, 30 days to expiration. That worked for 1 month in COVID and then you got your face ripped off, but it worked for a long time in the 2022 bear market. So if you don't test that condition, and let's say I'm assuming you're trying to come up with a bear market strategy as if you would know when the bear market would start, but that's a whole nother thing. But yeah, overfitting is definitely something to not do. Is like if you're doing moving averages, like, oh, like you mentioned before, like, oh, above the 50-day moving average, if you say, well, the 53-day moving average is way better, like that's when you're like, okay, it should be relatively close with the 30-day moving, you know, like maybe you get less trades or maybe you get more trades or whatever the thing is. But if you really start dialing it down, like 1% here, or what if I take profits at 37% versus 39%, those are clear signs of overfitting, and you can really come up with some, you know, some stuff there. I think one thing I'll just add to that is I like to look at the mark. I don't backtest as far as you're implying. I think
you probably don't need to be clear.
Yeah. I think there's something about SPX expirations going 5 days a week in mid 2022 or so. So going back to when I started trading, when there was only Friday expirations, I wouldn't have the confidence that that's going to apply. Like, you know, like you can't test 10 years of zero DTE,
right?
You know, because you're only going to get 50 trades, and when it was only Friday, you get 50 zero DTE trades in 2005 or whatever. So I think focusing on the more recent is kind of what I've gotten into with.
And I also think, to your point, it has to be relevant, right? Because you also have to imagine, with the introduction of daily expirations, that changes the quality of the expiration cycle in and of itself. Whereas previously, if you had your one expiration third Friday of the month, and that the market's going to behave so differently around that event.
Yeah.
And if there's expiration on Friday, and then there's another one on Monday, another one on Tuesday, and so on and so forth. So I think the relevance of what you're testing, exactly to your point, is super, super important.
Well, listen, man, this has been awesome. We'll definitely have to come back on and maybe talk a little bit more about a lot of things, but maybe we can narrow our focus. This is what happens when you don't talk enough. You just get all over the place, which is more fun.
That's a great point. Yeah, there was a ton of stuff to cover. And obviously, I love it. I love chatting with you. It's always a super fun conversation. So I had a blast.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks a lot. I will see you back in the next episode.
Beautiful. Thanks, man.